Sean Johnson joins me this week to discuss brewing porters and stouts. This is Beersmith Podcast number 157.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 157, and it's early October 2017. This week, Sean Johnson joins me to discuss brewing stouts and porters. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're running an amazing deal right now. Get 20% off your subscription when you use the code BEERSMITH2017. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. And you can read my new column called Ask the Experts there. Take advantage of their special deal when you use the offer code BEERSMITH2017 at beerandbrewing.com. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com. And also the new BrewVision thermometer from Blickman Engineering. This interactive wireless digital thermometer connects right to your iPhone or iPad and lets you remotely monitor and record temperatures. You can download your recipes right from the Beersmith Cloud and send updates and alerts as you brew. Get the BrewVision Bluetooth thermometer today. Another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith software, the industry standard for home and professional brewers. It lets you design great beer recipes and brew with confidence. Download your free 21-day trial today at beersmith.com. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome Sean Johnson. He's the assistant brewer at the Brewing Science Lab at the University of Northern Colorado. He works with Dr. Mosher, teaching a six-month hands-on certificate program in brewing. Sean has a master's degree in hop chemistry and worked at Anheuser-Busch in the barley research team before he joined UNC. Sean, it is great to have you on the show.
It's good to be on the show.
So how are things out there in Northern Colorado this time of year?
They're doing pretty good. The fall semester is underway and the students are in their chemistry classes, and we're just kind of waiting for the spring to start up the program again.
Awesome. And of course, you're a first-time guest. It's great to have you, but I understand you wanted to discuss porters and stouts today. Do you get a chance to brew a lot of porters and stouts? They're actually two of my favorite styles.
Oh, yeah. And right now, the Oktoberfest style is really popular because of the time of year, but the weather, as it gets colder, and here in Colorado, it's been in the 60s the past couple days. That really brings the dark beers into season for me.
Yep. And are you a fan of English porters and stouts, or do you prefer some of the other styles?
If it's good, I enjoy it. but the English styles are probably pretty high up there in terms of the dark beers and what I enjoy.
And why don't we start with a little bit about the history of porters? And one time, I understand these were pretty darn popular in England, right?
Oh, yeah. So the porter style was developed because brown ales and darker ales were really popular in England because of the way they had to kiln the malt. And the wood that they used to wood fire or heat the kilns with the fire would brown the malt. And over time, that allowed that kind of brown beer, brown ales to appear. And over time, the dock workers who went into the bars after work, one of these, 4% or lower beers that were nice and brown in color. And the dock workers were called porters. And so over time, the beer style just kind of grabbed that name as well. The first time it was ever mentioned, I think, was around 1721.
Mm-hmm.
But pretty much it got its name from the dock workers that enjoyed the style.
And as I understand it, this was before we had coke-fired kilns, so a lot of the barley was dark brown and also potentially smoked, right? It must have been.
Yeah, pretty much they had to deal with what they, could work with. And early on, they didn't have a way to keep the malt from getting burned when they were kilning it, so it just kind of, the style evolved because that was what was available to drink.
And stouts, of course, are somewhat related to porters. How closely related are they historically?
Originally, very. As time went on, they kind of split apart. Originally, you would go into a bar in England and you would ask for a stout porter. So basically, the bar would have their normal porter that they served, and then the stout porter would have, you know, more of something. It would be more alcohol typically, but it could be more hops or more malt. And that's kind of where the idea stout porter came from. And over time, as people kind of developed a flavor for these beers and a palate for these beers, they went in and just wanted the stout as its own thing rather than asking for the stout porter and expecting it to be the same beer but stronger. And this ultimately led to them splitting into two different styles of the porter and the stout.
And what are those, you know, how different are they now?
Now they're pretty different in the way they're brewed. The stouts get a lot more mouthfeel from different ingredients that you put into them. Porters are usually a little easier drinking, a little less, alcohol, a little less mouthfeel, more of a drinking beer rather than a sipping beer, which stouts, typically tend to lean closer to a sipping beer rather than a casual drinking beer, in my opinion.
And one of the interesting things you said is that these were fairly low gravity beers, more like a session beer today, right?
Yeah, definitely. The beer culture back in England was very much, you know, similar to how culture is today, that they wanted to, you know, make the most money off the ingredients they had. And unless you were really high up and really royal or in the royalty of one of the kingdoms or something like that, you wanted to stretch your malt and your grain out as far as you could. So you preferred these lighter beers because you could get more of them and you could have them, you know, in the middle of the day, and it wouldn't keep you from working in the afternoon or keep you from, you know, enjoying your nights. You would be able to have the beer and still enjoy, you know, yourself.
And interestingly, if we take something like the draft version of Guinness today, it's still a very low gravity beer, right?
Yeah, it's actually, people tend to think that dark beer means, you know, it's got to be really high alcohol and all of that. And a lot of the microbreweries do that with their dark beers. But typically, if you're going to do a true to style porter, it's a drinkable beer and it's 4 to 5% alcohol usually.
And as I understand it, we started to see porters and stouts kind of drop pretty rapidly in the 1800s as some of the lighter beers came into play, right?
Yeah, so the porters dropped out. Surprisingly enough, the stouts didn't so much. But the porters, in 1810, they invented the coke oven, so the new way to kiln the malt. And these new ways to kiln the malt basically kept the malt from getting charred when they were being kilned. So this allowed the beer to be clear, golden, and people preferred this because they could see that their beer was clear and clean, and they could see the bubbles, and they really preferred these styles of beers as opposed to the porters, which the darkness could conceal some of the impurities or imperfections that might be in the beer.
One of the other things I found interesting when I was doing some historical research, about the same time glasses started to get cheaper. For a long time, particularly in the 1700s, glass was actually very expensive. And so yeah. Very few people could afford to drink out of glassware that was clear. Kind of interesting.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, and that's awesome. Switching over to stouts, stouts actually stuck around during this time because in 1820, John Wheeler invented black patent malt. So people could use black patent malt to still make stouts. And so that style kind of stuck around during that time because the black patent malt that was created was good for stouts, but not so much for porters. It was a little too strong for porters.
And what are some of the styles of porters and stouts that we would recognize still today? Obviously, some of these have been revamped as the craft beer revolutions happened. But what are some of the styles we see today?
Yeah, there's a lot of revamping. A lot of the dark beers get vanilla and chocolate and things put in them from the craft scene. And nothing against that. Those beers are really good and they're really drinkable. But I always like to go back to the BJCP styles because that's kind of what I learned off of when I started homebrewing. And so for them now, it's the English porter, the American porter, and the Baltic porter, which go up in alcohol in that order.
And then on the stout side?
We've got, again, sweet stouts, oatmeal stouts, foreign export stouts, American stouts, and imperial stouts.
And one of the things I always find interesting is Russian imperial stout isn't really Russian, is it?
No, it was actually made to appease royalty. It was just given that kind of name because the Russian nobility really, really enjoyed that style, that really high alcohol, really dark beer. And so it kind of became known and associated with Russia because the nobility of Russia liked it so much. But I think it kind of came from that foreign export where they were upping the alcohol, upping the hops to kind of keep the beer clean. It could make the journey. It could survive the trip without getting infected. And in Russia, they just stuck to it. They really liked the style. And that's why most people remember Russian imperial stouts over most others.
And walk us through some of the stout styles that people, I think most people are familiar with Guinness. A lot of people hit Guinness and some people like it. Some people don't. I happen to enjoy it, but what are some of the other styles that people might not be that familiar with and might also enjoy?
It depends really on what you want. So sweet stouts are made with lactose. So they're really nice and sweet. And lactose is a milk sugar. So that gives it kind of that really milky, rich flavor. Oatmeal stouts, you use oats or flaked barley or something like that to kind of give it more of that mouth feel. And I'm sure most people are familiar or have had a American stout because it's pretty much any stout that you go over the board, over and above what is expected. That's pretty much the American style.
And what do you mean by over and above? Just over on gravity or what?
Yeah, American styles are typically known for taking a style and whether it's one or two or all of the characteristics, just kind of upping it a little bit higher. So you make it more hoppy, or you make it more malty, or you give it more alcohol, but something about it is out of proportion compared to one of the other styles, and it's just kind of beefed up, and that's pretty common with American styles.
And don't they tend to be a little bit cleaner than something like in a traditional English stout?
Yeah, I think that that ends up happening just because of the equipment available here, and when somebody's making that style, they can clean it up and they can kind of be pretty precise with what they want to do.
Okay. Well, let's talk for a minute about brewing, a traditional English porter, which is something I enjoy that has some complexity and depth to it. Mm-hmm. How would you approach the grain bill?
So for any style of beer that I'm trying to make from England or from Germany or from, Ireland, I'm going to try to use as many native ingredients from that area as I can. So I'm going to try to use a 2-row malt that's from English variety of barley. I'm going to try to use English hops, English yeast, as much as I can. And then I'm going to try to recreate the water profile and all of that as much as I can. Use crystal malts and caramel malts, maybe a little bit of chocolate or brown malt, but try to stick away from the really, really heavy, like Black Patent or really roasted barleys and malts that kind of lean towards the stout side.
So what kind of proportion might you use for, let's just pick a robust English porter, for example?
Proportion-wise, I'd probably do, I don't know as much percentage-wise, but if I was doing like a 5-gallon batch, which is typically what I do on my system at home, I'd use probably somewhere around 6.5-7 pounds of 2-row, probably 1 pound to 2 pounds of crystal, depending on the color and the variety. And then I'd probably use 0.5 pound to 1 pound of brown, maybe less if I'm using chocolate malt since it's a little bit darker.
And you actually like using the dark crystal malts, or I know they can be somewhat harsh, so can brown malt, actually.
Yeah, I like to use Crystal 60. That's kind of my go-to. I really like the flavor that one provides. I'm a big fan of the flavors and colors that I get from 60 on my system when I brew.
Yeah, I know when you get to the 80 and above, it starts to get into what Randy Mosher calls the harsh zone. And I did an article about that recently, but kind of that between 80 and, I don't know, roughly 200 Lovibond, a lot of the malts in there can be quite harsh.
Yeah, and that's more towards like if I was going to make a coffee porter or something like that, I might use a little bit higher to kind of simulate some more of that, you know, harsh flavor that you would expect to get from coffee. But if I'm just going to try to do a true to style drinkable porter, I'm going to stick with the 60 probably.
Have you tried making anything with a large proportion of brown malt? Maybe in the, you know, because brown malt, of course, is what was originally used for the traditional porters.
Early on when I started homebrewing, I tried something like that. I think that it was user error that turned it into a bad beer. I think that I fermented it in the summer and it was really hot. So that's the only time I've ever tried to use like a really significant portion of brown malt. I ended up finding a recipe that used crystal 80 and 120, and I readjusted the color with crystal 60, and I've kind of stuck with that recipe because I really enjoy the beer that it produces.
And how do you get complexity into the grain bill? I mean, for example, I don't like a single dimensional porter. I like something that has some depth to it.
You can always get complexity by adding, you know, other flavors. You can get, you can have a lot of fun with the dark beers because there's a lot of flavors that work in dark beers that wouldn't in others. So like raisin and plum, in small amounts can add some complexity, but also just playing around with the grain bill and playing around with the hop bill. You use, you know, a little bit of crystal 20 and a little bit of crystal 60, or you use a little bit of Maris Otter and a little bit of, you know, Pilsner malt or something like that. Maybe not Pilsner, but you know what, something along those lines, to where just kind of play around and mix and match the grain bill and the hop bill, give that some complexity so that it's not all just one step-by-step ingredient.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's switch over to stouts. What would a stout grain bill look like in contrast to a traditional English porter, say an English stout, for example?
So I like to use just two row of flaked oats or flaked barley, and then just hops and I'm trying to think of the name off the top of my head. I completely lost it. Not the black patent, but
barley.
Yeah. Roasted barley. Yeah. Roasted barley. The really dark gives it that nice coffee flavor. And then the oats, the flaked oats or the flaked barley, give it that nice mouthfeel. I've tried it with flaked rye before, wasn't the biggest fan of that, but it still kind of gave it the mouthfeel that I was looking for. I just didn't necessarily like the
right. So I mean, you're giving me basically a recipe for something like a Guinness, right? Because the roasted barley really gives you that coffee, strong coffee flavor, right?
Yeah, and that's when I drink stouts. I haven't dove much into milk stouts or sweet stouts using lactose or anything. I stick to the coffee and, really, really charred flavors that you can see in some stouts. And I really like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about hop varieties? What hop varieties would you recommend? Let's start with the porter.
The hops, the flavor of them to me gets lost because of the roasting of the barley and the other flavors are there. So I kind of just aim for bitterness from the hops. I don't try to do anything too much. I stick with UK Fuggle, East Kent Golding I'll use, and just other hops that'll give me good bitterness without trying to impart too much of a flavor profile on the beer, because I don't really want it to compete with that nice roasty and caramely flavor that you get from the malt.
Yeah, and if you play with something like a Fuggles, you're going to get more of that earthy kind of finish to things instead of kind of messy beer, English beer finish to it instead of something that's too clean, if you will.
Yeah, and I kind of like that earthy flavor that does come through that you get with the Fuggle and with those earthy hops. I think that they fit the style pretty well, in my opinion. I like drinking the beers I make with them.
Yeah, I use a lot of East Kent Goldings. Willamette is another good one. It's a Fuggles variant.
Yeah, Willamette. That's a really good one.
Those work well. And then would you do something different for the stouts? Obviously, you need a little more bitterness, probably.
Yeah, you need a little bit more. But I think the biggest thing is that just because it's a stout doesn't necessarily mean that there's a ton more that you have to counteract with the hops. You're going to get more roastiness from the malt and more mouthfeel from the grain bill, but you're not really going to need to overdo it on hops. You have to be careful not to make like a black IPA when you're trying to make a stout.
And do you have a guideline for, say, a traditional Guinness or something like that? How much bitterness does it need?
I typically, for my dark beers, try to stick in the 20 to 40 IBU range. If I'm going for a nice malty porter, I'll go to 20s. And if it's a stout that I want to be a little heavier and a little stronger, I might go up to the 35, 40 IBU range. But I try not to go above 40 for my dark beers.
Yeah, I would think 40 would be, again, something in the style of a Guinness, where you have that really sharp, roasted barley flavor that you're trying to offset, right?
Yeah, and that's pretty much what the goal is honestly, if you don't like how malty it is, you can try next time to add more hops. If you didn't like how hoppy it was, next time add a little bit less hops or a little more malt, and just kind of play around with the style until it's something that you really like.
But you probably wouldn't go that high with a traditional sweet stout or something like that, right?
Oh, no, I would definitely stay and continue to stick down in the 20s if I wanted to stay on the sweeter side.
Yeah. Let's see. And, let's talk about, yeast now. Do you prefer working with traditional ale yeast, or do you like something else?
Yeah. Again, in the same order as the rest of the ingredients, if I want it to be English style, I want to use English, yeast. If I want to do an Irish stout, I'm going to want to use Irish yeast, and so on and so forth. I think that, you know, those yeast are, from that region, they were used to brew those beers. So I don't see a reason to deviate from what already, worked.
So, do you have a recommended one from, White Labs, Y Yeast?
Oh, I do, but I don't remember it. I think it's just called, traditional English style yeast. And I forget if it's like 2 or 7 or 9. It's one of the early ones, but I believe it's just called traditional English ale yeast, if I'm remembering off the top of my head correctly.
Yeah, I think they have an English ale, and then there's an English ale 2 or something like that.
Yeah, and I like using those from White Labs. And if I'm remembering right, I think it's 007, but I could be wrong on that.
Okay. Well, I know water profiles play an important role, at least in some of these English styles. What advice do you have as far as water?
So the way that we always talk about it when we're teaching the students and when we're at the class is water is pretty much over 90%, over 95% of what beer is. It's mostly water. So you always have to take water into consideration anytime you're brewing. And so for us, it's very important when you're doing those English style dark beers to kind of mimic the English style water that they had at the time. And so that's a little bit more alkaline, a little bit higher sulfates. And you know, you want it to be a little bit harder than you would expect, you know, or that you would find at your normal water supply.
So are you working with, say, a London profile or something different? I mean, Dublin, for example, is much different than London's water profile.
Yeah, we like to do similar to London. We like to do right around the 100 part per million calcium level. We like around 250-ish of the carbonate. And then sulfates will get 50 to 100. We try to stay in that range.
So that's, fairly moderate water. It's not over the top like...
You definitely don't want to have Burton on Trent. No.
Yeah, anything like that, yeah.
Yeah, you definitely don't want Burton on Trent IPA, super bitter water. You just want it to be, you know, hard enough to where it'll give you that healthiness in your malt enzymes and your yeast, but you don't want to overdo it for sure.
And do you treat your mash water as well? Are you worried about mash pH, those kinds of things?
If we can get the mash pH to 5.2-ish, That's what we're aiming for. And usually we can get that by adding the carbonates and things like that. It's usually right around that. I think it's 5.2 around is what we shoot for.
Yeah, it's easier with a darker beer. Obviously, you got more acidity from the malt itself, right?
Yeah, the kilning does a good job of adding that acidity to the malt, and that transfers over in the mash for sure.
And we talked a little bit about this earlier, but, flavor complexity is something that comes just not just from the malt build, but throughout the process. What advice do you have to get sort of this, instead of the American porter, which might be a lot cleaner or something like that, what advice do you have for getting some of the complexity and depth into a traditional porter or stout?
I think that it's a really good idea to make sure that you're doing things true to style. Find a solid base that you can work with, tweak it around a little bit to make it your own. But I would recommend, sticking with the basics, do an English two-row, do some crystal malts, and then stick with English hops and English yeast.
Mm-hmm. And any other advice in terms of grain bills or anything?
Honestly, I've always been a believer of kind of make it your own. For my grain bills, when I first started homebrewing, I always went and found something online. Then I went to the local homebrew shop and they wouldn't have everything. So I kind of mixed and matched and made it my own. And I think that that's just the best way to get your own style and get the complexity and get the beers that you want, is to just play around and tweak little things at a time. You know, use, you know, EKG 1 week and then use Willamette the next, and then if you don't like the difference between those, go back to what you like and tweak something else, and, you know, just kind of slowly work your way into a beer that's yours.
Okay. And we spent quite a bit of time talking about the English styles. Maybe let's say a few words about the American variations of stout and porter.
Yeah, the American variations, I mean, they do a lot of good things, a lot, especially when you go to a lot of the craft breweries. They do a good job of making a stout that's really malty, and they add, you know, a lot of them add these really awesome flavors to it. We have a brewery here in Greeley that just made a cinnamon and chocolate stout that's 10%, that's absolutely, you know, amazing to drink. And it's all those complexities. They, you know, shot the alcohol way up, and because of that, they were able to add those other flavors, and the alcohol kind of counterbalances those harsh cinnamon and chocolatey notes, and it actually blends together to make a really, really nice beer.
And I know a lot of American breweries are playing with hops, of course. I've had some good ones, for good porters made with Centennial, for example. Have you played around at all with the Northwestern varieties of hops?
I mean, I've used some. I don't know, is Magnum Northwestern? I've used Magnum before.
It's a high alpha hop, if I remember.
Yeah, it's a very high alpha. So I've used Magnum before to try to do really high bitterness without getting very much flavoring, so that I can get a lot of those like malty and caramely flavors to come through of the beers. But in terms of playing around with hops, I typically stick to the safe ones that everybody uses. I'm not a huge hop experimenter in dark styles. I'll go out of my way to experiment when I'm doing an IPA and stuff like that, because I'm interested in finding the flavors and the aromas that you get from all these different hop styles. But in terms of my darker beers, I usually stick to the standards.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts, since you were on the topic of IPAs. Of course, there's a huge trend, particularly on the West Coast, to push a lot of these dark IPAs sort of to extremes. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so the dark IPAs are definitely a big deal. And it's surprising. I've had a few that are really good, and I've had a few that pretty much just taste like a normal IPA. If they do it right, there is a nice balance you can get between the bitterness that you can get from making it an IPA, and the roastiness of the malt, and all of that coming together can make a very beautiful and complex beer. But a lot of people just try to make a traditional IPA or double IPA and just use roasted malt in its place. And I haven't tried to make one myself, but it seems to be an art that some people have mastered and other people are still getting the hang of.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of any other styles we didn't cover. We didn't talk much about the sweet stouts, Baltic porters. I was wondering if you had, any advice for brewing, say, a Baltic porter.
A Baltic porter, I mean, you just kind of use more base malt. You can add a little bit of sugar in the boil kettle if you want to, up the alcohol like a Baltic porter without, affecting the mash bill or grain bill too much, or the roastiness too much. It's pretty much just, you know, stick with your original plan, get some more base malt to up the alcohol, and try to not let the alcohol overwhelm the rest of the beer. And if you brew a Baltic porter where the alcohol is really overwhelming, try to counteract it with some more crystal or maybe a little bit more hops or something like that to kind of balance that out.
And you keep mentioning a lot of crystal. I actually have stopped using as much crystal in a lot of my beers because sometimes I get sort of off flavors from it. What are your thoughts on that?
I haven't run into that issue personally. We here in Northern Colorado are lucky to have a lot of very local maltsters and barley growers and stuff like that. So a lot of our stuff is very fresh and very well done. And, you know, we're right close to Fort Collins and Loveland and Denver. So the craft beer scene here is huge. And I think because of that, a lot of the maltsters here take a lot of pride in their small business malting. Mm-hmm. And that seems to help a lot with the crystals that we're able to obtain and use it. I haven't noticed any off flavors from it.
And then last, I want to mention sort of the equivalent of a Baltic porter, perhaps, would be a Russian Imperial Stout. And the key, again, is it seems to be balancing the alcohol with all the other flavors, right?
Yeah, with the Imperial Stouts, the Russian Imperial specifically, it's pretty in style to be able to taste the alcohol, especially when it gets that high. So if you're trying to make a Imperial Stout and you don't taste the alcohol, I would think that you want to scale back on some of your hops or some of your malt at that point, because that style should be a sipping beer. It should be a beer that's really strong in alcohol, along with the other flavors with that alcohol burn, but definitely you should be tasting it in that.
So it's all kind of over the top, right?
Oh, yeah. It's over the top while not going crazy on hop profile or maltiness. It's a nice beer that you drink, and it kind of reminds you of winter and warms you from the inside.
Yeah, I've been toying with the recipes, trying to develop one here. I want to, my goal is I made a mead, a straight sweet mead that was a little too sweet. And so what I was planning to do is brew a Russian Imperial Stout this winter and then blend the two and make a Russian Imperial Braggot, if you will. So
that sounds like it could be absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I've had Moonlight Meadery, Michael Fairbrother, made one that was absolutely fantastic. I think it took him 7 years to make it, but
only seven?
It was out of this world, yeah. So I've got this 5 gallons of mead sitting here waiting for the Russian Imperial Stout to be brewed.
And I mean, that could definitely, the sweetness of that mead and the high alcohol should definitely complement that beer pretty well, I would think.
Yeah, I just got to make sure I make it over the top enough to offset the super sweet mead, like I said. Yeah.
Yeah, and you could, I'm hoping a Russian Imperial Stout can help offset that sweetness. If it can't, I don't know very many beers that could.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, I wondered if you had any final tips on porters or stouts?
I think that with most beer styles, there's such an awesome community around craft beer, and there's so many awesome websites you can use as references. If you have any questions about anything that you're doing, or you can put your recipe online, people will flock to give you advice and tell you what they've done in its place, or if they've done something similar and what they noticed from these beers. And I think that the online community around the craft beer scene and the homebrew scene is just really a wonderful resource to have.
Absolutely. I've gotten to where I just, you know, basically go online and start looking for sample recipes and then kind of pull from those a lot of times when I'm trying to do something new.
Yeah, I think that that's a great way to do it. That's how I do most of my recipes anymore, because, you know, there's no reason to try to reinvent the wheel. If people have produced these great beers, why not take the beer and take the base of it and tweak it a little bit, make it your own? But if it's already great, I wouldn't, you know, try to do too much to it.
Well, I wanted to take a minute here at the end and give you an opportunity to talk about the program you have going on at the University of Colorado brewing program. I think you said it's a 6-month brewing certificate program.
Yeah. So at the University of Northern Colorado, we have a 6-month program where the first semester of it is in the spring, and that's all online. You can do that from anywhere. It's all online. After that, we have 2 courses in the summer that are 3 weeks long each. They meet from Monday to Friday, 8 to 5. The first class, you work in the chemistry laboratories at UNC, and you will do ASBC methods. We do over 30 quality control methods on beer from grain to beer. We cover everything. And then after that course, we have a 3-week course that meets at the brewery we have on campus, which is a 7-barrel steam fired system that the students get hands-on experience. They get to work in the brew house. They brew 3 batches of beer during that time. And it's a really awesome place for them to learn how to work on the equipment.
And can you talk a little about the ASBC methods? Because a lot of homebrewers may not be familiar with that stuff.
Yeah, so that's the American Society of Brewing Chemists. And basically, they've since the 80s, they've had this huge booklet that's always expanding of different ways to test for, you know, different parameters in your beer to make sure that the beer you brew on Monday and the beer you brew on Friday are the exact same beer. And so we go over analyses on how to test your grain to make sure your grain is the same every time, how to test your wort to make sure your wort is the same, the bitterness from your hops, because hops, like other plants, they can vary from season to season. So you need to know the bitterness, exactly what you're getting out of those hops, so that you know exactly how much to put in your beers so that they're not, you know, varying from one batch to the next.
That's awesome. Yeah, I started, I was playing the other day with some of the ASBC. They've put out a new standard for doing sensory perception on malts. I don't know, you've probably seen that, I'm sure.
Yeah, we are actually in the process. We're going through trying to improve how much sensory we can provide. Right now, we do a little bit with the kits from the Siebel Institute and do some training in that sense, but we're trying to put together some more sensory stuff to help people out in that field.
Is that the off flavor kits that they put out?
Yeah, it's just the ones that you can get on their website.
Yeah, I've been using those at actually the Brew Your Own event. I usually we go through those and do a sensory evaluation with the team there. It's kind of fun. Let's see, I wanted to ask, where can you find out more about the program? I'll throw up the website, but maybe you can tell people where to go.
Yeah, so you can go to the website, which is extended.unco.edu/brewing, or you can just email brewing@unco.edu. We're also on social media at UNCO Brewing.
Great, Sean. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Thank you for having me on the show. It was great talking about porters and stouts. Had a lot of fun. And if you ever want to know some chemistry of beer stuff, I'd be happy to come back.
Well, thank you, Sean. I appreciate it. It's been great having you on the show as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, a big thank you to Sean Johnson for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue is packed with great information for homebrewers and craft beer fans. Take advantage of their special sale and get 20% off when you use the offer code BEERSMITH2017 at beerandbrewing.com. And also Blickman Engineering, creators of the innovative new BrewVision wireless thermometer. Remotely monitor your brewing system from your iPhone or iPad, record data, set alerts, and grab recipes directly from the BeerSmith cloud. The BrewVision thermometer, another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. And BeerSmith software, the industry standard for home and professional brewers that lets you design great beer recipes and brew with confidence. Download your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.